So forget it.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to attempt to give you a bit of an overview of the field of quantum control and what we're trying to do in this particular workshop, with a little bit of a summary of what of sort of some of the prime achievements, which actually, if you notice this, this actually is a quote from the Nobel Prize in Physics last year, coherent control of individual quantum systems, starting with this. And then I will show you, I'll show you sort of the motivating features from quantum information, which come up really here, number three. And then I want to show you what we can learn about science rather than about engineering devices. In the last two sections in quantum simulation and also the outlook, which some of us are exploring here, on quantum control for biology. So let me start with maybe the first controller, who was the Maxwell daemon, or is the Maxwell daemon. So, the classic picture of the Maxwell daemon is that there's this little daemon, and my visual skills are limited, I should say. You know he's a daemon because he has this on his tail. Right. So this daemon is tasked to reduce the entropy of this system of gaseous atoms in a bipartite compartment. And the daemon, so the daemon reduces the entropy of the system by taking all of the fast molecules and putting them on the left, those sorts, fast molecules to the left. And so the daemon is sitting here and basically interrogating all of the molecules and then saying if they're slow, then move them to the right and pass to the left. So, and it's assumed that the daemon can reversibly measure and make operations to move the molecules around. So, we know, so this was posed originally as a conundrum, that the entropy of a closed system would be reduced, and therefore the entropy of the universe would increase. Okay, so we know this has been resolved. We know that's not true. The resolution comes because the daemon gains an information. And in, so he can gain information because he knows, he or she knows, which molecules are fast and which are slow, and is then putting them in places which are also still stored in his memory. So Bennett showed in 1982 that any daemon, however, cannot store infinite amounts of information, and so eventually the daemon will have to erase the memory, and erasing the memory will dissipate entropy, raise the entropy of the environment. So that's the resolution of the paradox. So, and then in quantitatively, you can show that this is then consistent with the second law, so no violation. Okay. So this is a useful thing to bear in mind when we're thinking about doing quantum control to achieve some kind of quantum processing, because we're generally trying to do the kind of control that this daemon is doing on individual quantum degrees of freedom. And we can, and we do learn a lot about the system thereby, but of course it is, there's a cost associated with it. So this is just then historical. So the moral of the story is that information costs or control. gives information, but it also costs. Okay. So this kind of experiment has been realized to some extent. It's been realized to some extent recently with dipole trapped atoms. So, in fact, precisely this. So, if one has a dipole trap and have atoms coming from the left or from the right, and then if one imposes additional barriers with laser fields here, one can have here a barrier beam and this one is a repumping beam, and at the well, and if the atom is in FS2, then the barrier will be a positive barrier, and the particles can't go through. So if one has atoms incident on this side in a mixture of FS1 and FS2, the FS1 can go through and will go to the other side. Then on this side, one has a repumping action to turn those into FS2, and that they can't go back through this barrier because of the potential, so they are forced to stay here. So this way, you eventually sort all the put all the FS1 atoms on the right-hand side, and the FS2 atoms can go on the left-hand side. FS1 atoms are on both sides, and FS2 is on this side. Okay, this is not with memory. There's no memory here. But when we do quantum information processing, we actually are trying to do something more akin to Maxwell's daemon. If we have, for instance, an optical lattice, so we might have an optical lattice which has some kind of partial filling, and we want to then make this to some perfectly occupied lattice, one atom in every site. Then one can achieve this. Hasn't yet been done experimentally, but we and Dave Weiss have shown that you can do it theoretically. You can achieve this with a compacting scheme, which basically consists of imaging, which gives you the memory, imaging followed by cooling to get everything in the vibrational ground state, and then state selective. So these are atoms are also atoms with different hyperfine levels, state selective translations, and also state selective transitions. So you can move them around, you can, depending on the state, you can do all this with lasers. So this is compacting scheme with lasers. So this is a kind of detailed control that's being developed experimentally. So this is, and it goes to a zero entropy state. So let me give you just a couple of highlights of the really state-of-the-art experimental work that was cited in the Nobel Prize. So in the Wineland group at NIST, they focused on trapped ions in traps. And here one has an ion trapped in some a pole trap, so it has some vibrational modes. And what is used are, again, internal states. And we often write these internal states as just having two, because we're thinking towards quantum information processing. We only want two for a qubit. But in general, and in practice, one often uses many more levels. Okay, so one might isolate those two for addressing, but one takes advantage of the other levels to do transitions. So one of the nice results from here, already in 1996, was a demonstration that one could, with a single atom, make a mesoscopic superposition state. So this would be, if one started with the initial state of, so if I take, I'll call these two states here, up and down, or 0 and 1, using the qubit notation. Okay, so we start in a state which is a product state of the vibration. So this is a vibration, and this is the internal state. So internal and external degrees of freedom. So they showed that by using different kinds of Raman transitions on this atom and vibrational system, that they could generate states of the form where the distance, where x1 and x2 are essentially displaced coherent states, which if I draw them up here, so we start off with something like we have a potential, if we start off with the wave function here in the ground, this is the V is 0, and this is the V is 1, then we go to, this is a V is 0 state of the left, of the down internal state, and then, so this is basically state selective Raman. That gives us a superposition of these two components here, okay, where this distance, the width of these states in real space is about 7 nanometers, but the distance between them is 80 nanometers. Okay, so then that's why they're referred to as mesoscopic states. So what one's using here are lasers addressing this ion in the trap, and one's basically using Raman transitions giving megahertz or gigahertz effective transitions to address the internal degrees of freedom and the vibrational degrees of freedom. So this, as I shall show in a minute, is very, very important for one of the most advanced physical implementations of quantum computation today. But before I do that, let me then mention an experiment from Serge Haros, DNS. And Haros has been studying Rydberg atoms in high excited states, so N is about 50, and also high angular momentum states, which means that they're very, very large states. L is approximately 49, just close to L, and the dimension of this, the radius, is then approximately 125 nanometers, very large Rydberg states. And he puts these in a microwave cavity. So using this approach, they have created Fock states of the cavity, or of the microwave field. So states of definite photon number. They've also created superpositions, coherent superpositions of coherent states with displaced, relative displacement between the the main maxima and the amplitudes, and also again an entangled atom-photon state, such as this one, which is the analog for this system of this particular state here, entanglement between two degrees of freedom. So the important thing for us, at least in this program, in terms of this work here, is how this was actually achieved. So this was achieved by using feedback control. And so let me just say what's involved in that, because that's a big theme of our conference. So what they do is they send these Rydberg atoms through this this microwave cavity, and so initially the cavity is set up by a microwave by a laser source to create a coherent state alpha inside the cavity. The Rydberg atoms here are sensors. They pick up phase information. They pick up a phase shift as they go through the cavity, and the phase shift in the regime in which this cavity is operated, the phase shift depends on the number of photons in the cavity. So phase shifted by the number of photons. So then one makes an estimation of what the state of the cavity actually is, and then one has see how far one is from the target Fock state that you want to make. So let's call it just alpha t. And then the feedback occurs by modifying the classical source field driving the cavity to shift the actual state of the cavity, alpha, to closer to the desired target. So this is quite an accomplishment, and
what is the target?
The target would be actually this state. It's the state of the cavity. This is, so the design here is to make a controlled state of the photon field, not of the atoms. The atoms are just sensing. Yeah, they force it into a Fock state. So they can, with this feedback, they can, on demand, create a Fock state in about 20 milliseconds, and they can see quantum jumps as the cavity emits spontaneously, and they can then fix the control to bring it back up. So they can really stabilize the Fock states over long periods of time. Okay. So it takes essentially 20 milliseconds to create the Fock state. So this is a beautiful example of feedback on a quantum system. So now, with this as sort of a preamble, let me sort of write a classification, I'll come back here, of how we envisage the different tools available to us in quantum control. So, and in particular, we want to do this because we want to now really scale up these coherently controlled quantum systems Well, let's just take a scale up. Write everything down there. Scale up. Okay. So, if we can scale up to many atoms, many photons, interacting systems, I mean, if we can scale up to something where they're only very weakly interacting or not interacting, fine, but we really want interacting systems in order to be able to take advantage of the interactions to make some kind of quantum computation. And so all these wonderful things are promised if we can scale up this kind of control to large arrays of quantum systems. So if we just put quantum in front of computation, communication, and simulation. Okay. So, of course, there are big problems. So, two problems, and one really major one is, of course, decoherence. And this is especially a problem in solid state. Less of a problem for these atomic systems. But the true scalable systems in the long run are expected to be solid state, and this is where decoherence really is a major issue. Another problem is that looking back at Maxwell, it's a demon. Well, in practice, no operations that you make on the system will be perfect. And so you won't be able to have a perfect Maxwell demon inside your quantum machine. You'll have entropy production. From imperfect quantum operations. And there's various ways to deal with this. Error correction. So one needs to deal with this. One is developing hard, long error correction. Another one which we're focusing on in this workshop is to remove the entropy by some kind of dissipated coupling. And this is something which has really arisen in the last few years in this field. By dissipative. Namely, the idea that we can use decoherence or dissipation to actually help us control a system. So I think what I have next slide. So the old CW was we need to completely suppress decoherence. And the new CW is, well, maybe we can make use of it. To drive the system either to a particular initial state or to drive it into some non-steady state. Okay. So that's sort of the overall view and the perspective. And we have at this conference workshop, we have a lot of discussion about our toolbox. So I'm going to write a very simple summary of our toolbox here. And it certainly isn't the last word. There's a big discussion on our Wikispace page about how we categorize things. But let me just, for the purposes of today, for those of you not used to this, just make a distinction, the following distinction between open loop control, which is where we would, yeah, let's do a different color now. We have a controller. And the controller is exerting some influence. So, putting some input, it could be a laser pulse, onto the system, which is then achieving, hopefully, the desired effect. And as a special class of this, which is actually very commonly used experimentally, there's what we refer to as learning control. Where where, which is also as a form of open loop control, in which we have multiple copies of our system, S1. The first one gets, say, the first pulse. Then, whatever comes out is then processed and analyzed. So we have a process, processing and learning. Stage here, and then after we've learned something, we improve our input and we run the experiment again on a second copy of the system. Okay, so this is basically just going around iteratively. I mean, I say going around, that sort of implies closed loop, but this is iteratively improving the control signals to achieve the desired result. And this, for the biologists, this is often used. This often uses very sophisticated genetic algorithms. But it's not real biology, of course. Then we have the third one, which is really now the major focus. A major focus of this program is closed loop, and I will actually just refer to it as feedback. Closed loop. Okay, and here we have a somewhat more complicated set of boxes. We have our system here, which is receiving input from a controller, but the controller, let me write the controller at the top here, the controller also has at its disposal an estimator. So this is precisely the step here in the Hirosh experiment, where based on the phase shifts of all these Rydberg atoms coming through here, the state of the cavity field was estimated. And then information from the system is then brought around here, and it can either be measured directly, which is what happened in the Hirosh experiments, or one could just feed this round directly, and that's more of a coherent. So feedback control has several different flavors. The usual one that's done is measurement, but some people here are working on the coherent control, where you just feedback directly the quantum information without looking at it. So in this respect, so both of these, even though this is measurement converts the information into a classical signal, both of these differ somewhat from a classical control loop, which can be, classical control loops can either be deterministic or probabilistic, depending on the amount of noise in the system. Here, because we either are doing completely coherent, but if we're doing a measurement-based control feedback here in the on a quantum system, we always have a stochastic feedback description because of the stochastic nature of the measurement. Okay, so there's a subtle distinction here from the classical control literature.
How big is this cavity?
Oh, I don't know. You mean how big physically?
Well, another way.
It's
how large?
Or how large N can they make? They have made up to about 12 or maybe even 20. Not more than 20. However, yeah, but then you can make this. I showed you the fog state production because that's where they use the feedback. They haven't used feedback to create these. But these are not classical states.
Well, just below there, you say you wrote feedback. See?
Yeah, but it's only for this experiment. This experiment has feedback. This experiment.
I think you would say N big, work with N well defined, give extremely non classical states of definite number of.
Oh, yeah, pure Fock state is not a classical state.
so it's a quite a big challenge. I mean, one of the big achievements in this experiment was using the feedback that, like Fermia mentioned, using the fact that it's a superconducting cavity, but it still has finite loss. And so the challenge, typically Beagle variance would make this something more approaching a semi-classical state. But through the feedback, they're able to kind of determine it, you know, like through the error signal, inject microwaves back into the cavity in just the right way that they can keep it in this non-classical state.
So they're starting off with a coherent state, which is a superposition, but they then, this guy actually is then no longer a coherent state.
I think the order of magnitude of the cavity was about 10 centimeters.
10 centimeters, okay. Okay.
These are microwaves, so they're big fat.
So I can say one more thing. So this is with atoms in a cavity. The solid state people who do circuit QED, also CQED, confusingly, put a superconducting qubit in a microwave cavity. And the Yale group has, I haven't seen the results, but they tell me they have now managed to make Fock states with up to 100 photons. This is brand new. It's pretty amazing. Okay.
Plastic feedback, anything like what Bollinger discovered for cooling accelerator?
Alright, I'm not the person to say that. Maybe.
Cooling. I mean, it's related, of course, to these issues of removing entropy by the entropy system knowings. So I think there is a close relation to system fast cooling, but it's, of course, the challenge with the interesting parts for quantum control is the quantum measurement problem. The fact that when you're measuring, there's the
intrinsic
disturbance on the system. So how do you measure in a way that gives you the information you want without disturbing the information you don't want to disturb? It's one of the challenges in the system.
Well, I think that was controversial at the time. There were a lot of people saying it couldn't be done.
It could be. I think it's a question of, there are always, of course, irreducible disturbance in the measurement. But the degree to which the quantum noise in the system affects it will depend on the details of the system you want to control.
Okay. So now I'll give you just a little bit of an overview of where we are with the scale up. First of all, with trapped ions, we have virtually everything here is in place to make a quantum process. And small-scale quantum processes of 2 or up to 10 ions as qubits have been implemented. Error correction has been demonstrated. Fault tolerance has been demonstrated. So readout is very easy. All the elements that one needs to make a quantum computer the components have really been demonstrated with small numbers of trapped ions. The problem with trapped ions, however, is that if you want to make a large-scale device, you need to basically figure out how to get the ions to talk to each other. And so the current ideas are that one has some interaction regime and memory regimes in which ions are stored here, memory. And the ions will then be shuttled in and out of the interaction region to carry out the operations. So, ion shuttling. But this is actually a very hard problem. This is also a problem where coherent control can help. And so what one's controlling here is basically voltage control. And with an important aspect of coherent control is normally you have some constraint. Here you want to minimize the energy constraint, minimize the energy that you're imparting to the system that would go, for instance, into unwanted vibrational excitations. And you also want to do it fast, with minimized energy and do fast. So you could minimize energy if you do everything adiabatically, but adiabatically will not get you a very useful result. So you have this, as always in quantum information processing, you have a sort of a yin and a yang of, which is a term I learned from Ivan, of mutually apparently incompatible requirements. So I won't say more about trapped ions because they really are well on the way. Now, what I would like to say a little bit about is scale up is solid state. And then I will move to, so I'm here right now, then I'll move to quantum simulation. So for solid state, so what do we mean by solid state? Well, so there's famous, many different varieties of implementations. There's electrons in silicon, or nuclear spins in silicon. That's a fairly popular one right now. And then there's also superconducting qubits. Okay, so here, even a single spin control and readout is already hard. Very challenging. So, but again, these systems have taken longer to develop or to have the control, same kind of control realized that the gas phase systems of atoms and ions have, trapped atoms and ions. But recently, again, there's progress been made, and so electrons in either in the form of from a dopant or on a quantum dot in silicon have recently been shown how you can make a spin-dependent readout of these using basically a single electron transistor and measuring. So you basically have a source and a drain, the SET here, and you're measuring the current through the SET. And if you set the voltages right, control this, you can set this up so that a spin up electron will go across, but the spin down electron will not go across. So you can have spin selective single spin selective detection now. So this was a major breakthrough a couple of years ago. And now in this area, there's also a lot of work on considering how to do then electron shuttling. And some of the people here are working on that, electron shuttling between these dopant atoms or between quantum dots embedded in silicon device. So, and again here, the control is just like here. I put this on up here, is voltage control. Okay, so as long as the process, and here it's the transport process is treated quantumly, it's not just photons that we're using as control fields, it's also electric fields. And this problem is interesting because here we want to, as the electron is shuffled from one space to another, charge degree of freedom is being moved, there's interaction with the nuclear spins of the environment and phonons and so on. So there's a lot of work that has to be done here to ensure that such a motion of electrons in a solid remains coherent, and that the internal degrees of freedom of the qubit, in this case particular, the spin degree of freedom of the electron, are preserved, just as you can do here with the ion shuttling.
Is there some technique for the second one to use the decoherence to your advantage?
I don't believe yet on this. So now let me give you an example of something where you can use decoherence to your advantage. that I've got. So all of this is so far really still in the, this all falls into the open loop category. Learning control, if you want, as did the experiments I mentioned from NIST. These were all open loop type control. Okay, so let's see. I should say one more thing about, okay, two more things. Let's have a look how much time I have. Let me just, without going into too many details, say one word about how one actually does suppress decoherence. There's a very general set of tools. Which are basically based on spinocular technology techniques. So for instance, supposing you had a two-level system and subject to a noise, Hamiltonian, which will, in a classic quasi-classical description, represent as a fluctuating amplitude times sigma z on the two-level system. So this is going to just jiggle the energy separation here, and this is a stochastic variable here, and that gives rise to dephasing. So the classic way, the starting point for fixing this dephasing noise is a Hahn echo, Hahn-Spin echo, which is just, if you consider a qubit, going from the, okay, let me just write this in the xy plane, x and y. So if one has a pi over 2 pulse at time 0, that brings the qubit into the state, into the xy plane, and wait some time t. So the Bloch vector is in the xy plane here, equatorial plane. After some time t, one makes a pi rotation around the y-axis. And so before you get here, you would have, due to these dephasing processes, there would be a spread out of all the members of an ensemble in this direction. These are spreading out this way. The pi rotation will reverse these Bloch vectors so that one then has this coming back in here, and then one waits another time t, and here one has the echo. Okay, so with the this simple two pulse sequence will remove zero frequency dephasing noise. And there's a very powerful and now broadly developed set of tools, pulses, going under the name dynamical decoupling, which have been developed from this, basically where one design pulses to cancel out specific terms in the system bath interaction. So this is one very simple example. It's a pure dephasing HSB. Okay, I forgot to say one other thing here. Okay, right. So for instance, so you basically have a pulse, H system bath, pulse dagger, so, and then you basically design a pulse that will take your system bath interaction and turn it to the inverse, so then when you average over long times, the effect of the system bath interaction is averaged out. So this is very, very powerful. Then I should say one more thing on individual solid-state qubits, which is feedback stabilization is also very recently been realized for these. So these superconducting qubits are catching up with the gas phase qubits. So this is an experiment done by my colleagues Irfan Siddiqui at Berkeley, who has basically a what's called a transmon qubit, which is one of the superconducting qubits, inside also a 3D microwave cavity. And he implements feedback protocol and to stabilize Rabi oscillations. And let's see, I'm not very good at drawing these. If you have no feedback, then these are approximately decaying on 2 microseconds. This is Rabi oscillation stabilization. And this is again a measurement-based feedback. And the reason that both this and the microwave, the Hirosh experiments were possible because of major advances that these researchers have made in the measurement technology associated with their qubits. But if Siddiqui applies feedback, then this oscillation can basically go on forever, as far as they know. Well, maybe not forever, but certainly for the patience of a graduate student. I think they've measured it out to about 1 millisecond, but there's no reason why it shouldn't go on longer, because it's continually being stabilized. Every time it fluctuates away, it's continually being put back. Right, so now let me say a few words about quantum simulation. Okay? So this is all really sort of the where we are with the technology, what kind of controlled challenges have been met or have had to be overcome to get us to this point where we can talk about certainly individual qubits, and in the gas phase systems we can talk about coupling them. In the solid state, we're still really characterizing the individual qubits, but the coupling will come. So now let me move to quantum simulation. Can I erase this slide? And then I'll have a few minutes on. Well, so there's two flavors of quantum simulation. One is where one just, which we call the analog mode, in which we try to build a Hamiltonian from one system that emulates a Hamiltonian of another. And this is, of course, something of great interest to solid state physics, because we can, with H simulation is going to be some particular system Hamiltonian. So with neutral atoms, we have Fermi-Hubbard Hamiltonians. With ions, spin Hamiltonians, and also with dipolar molecules, our colleagues in the dipolar molecule program here can also make very nice, or in theory, can make very nice collections of diverse spin Hamiltonians. So we have sigma. Okay. Plus, etc. So, in fact, these really give the opportunity. Part of the interest in this area right now is this is the new science now. This is not to build a quantum processor. The opportunity that these give is to make new quantum phases. Because by engineering these kinds of spin interactions between dipolar molecules, neutral atoms, or ions, but doing them in something other than the native condensed state, matter state, we have ability to probe regions of the phase diagrams which aren't accessible to us in the naturally occurring systems. So one here of great interest to a lot of people here are the topological phases. And these require many body interactions, at least 4 body interactions. And it's quite straightforward, once you know what you're doing, to generate these 4 body interactions or higher order interactions with any one of these systems. And in particular, experiments have been done with ions. This is from Rainer Blatt's group in Innsbruck. Experiments with ions have implemented interactions, Hamiltonians, which look of the following form, gamma x1, x2, x3, x4. So where these are sigmas, right? Maybe I should use the same notation. Sigma, sigma x1, sigma x2, sigma x3, sigma x4. Four ions, which are basically equidistant. This is one of the components of the Kataev model, the simplest possible model of a topological phase. Okay, now one of the things that was done in this experiment, which was done with a finite set of ions, was to address this entropy problem. So if one has a finite set of atoms or qubits on which one's making operations which will set up these interactions, you have some errors, and that will generate entropy. So what they did here was to something which we and also other groups have looked at with different variants. Basically, the basic idea is to add to your system qubits, or the degrees of freedom that you want to actually be involved in this simulation, you add a set of ancilla species. So let's suppose this was ions. Okay, so these are ancillas, and these would be the ions which one's actually having interact with each other, and these are somehow mapped by their interactions onto this equidistant system. Okay, so the key here is to design the coupling between the ancillas and the ions, such that when you, maybe let me draw this differently. If I draw this, because I want to dissipatively pump, so the key is to engineer the coupling, so these are coupled with some coherent interaction, and then to dissipatively pump the ancillas. And it's the dissipative pumping of the ancillas that gets rid of the entropy. And you can do this, certainly for ions and atoms, quite nicely using optical pumping. Take advantage of this. But the key is to do this in such a way such that, so this is what we mean by engineering the dissipation. So we're engineering this interaction here, which is this critical system bath interaction term. We're engineering this to ensure that the qubits, the quantum system, let's build them like this, that these guys are driven, in fact the entire system, the entire coupled system of ancillas and qubits are driven into the ground state. So that was what was done in this experiment to ensure cooling. More generally, Kevin Young over here with one of the group Berkeley that showed that we can actually do this and choose, we can dial in with this dissipative coupling, we can dial in any arbitrary thermal state, any arbitrary temperature. And this actually is quite useful for studying topological phases because there's a big question about whether they're stable at anything other than zero temperature. Okay, so this dissipative coupling or engineering the H system bath is now of great interest in the community. Sometimes it's referred to as reservoir engineering. And it's been used and in experiments by Eugene Polzig to generate entangled states of atomic ensembles, basically just by driving the system in such a way with a given coupling to the dissipative environment that you're driving, that the system just naturally settles into, in his case, a large-scale entangled state. So this is really something new over the last 3 or 4 years. So that's, I think, all I'll say about simulation, because I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about biology. So I had a couple of other things on simulation, but I'll have to skip those. So biology is over here, and I took the time to draw the time-consuming diagrams here before. Let me move down here. Okay, so there's a lot of talk about quantum, non-trivial quantum effects in biology these days. And by quantum, non-trivial quantum effects, we really mean quantum dynamical effects. Obviously, biology is quantum mechanical. Every molecule is, we know from everything here, has quantum behavior and the energy level structure, and the barriers to reactions obviously have a very big effect on biological systems. But that's not what the current interest in quantum effects in biology is about. It's really looking for non-trivial or dynamical quantum effects. So one that's been very widely studied and where there's a lot of interest in doing control is light harvesting. Another one which I want to mention is the cis-transisomerization of rhodopsin type species. Maybe I will start with the rhodopsin. Well, no, okay, let me start with this because this is quick. So here, basically, if you have a lighter harvesting complex, and this particular green sulfur bacteria is rather special. It has this big complex containing hundreds of thousands of light-absorbing molecules known as chlorophylls. And they directly absorb the light. And then there's this interface between the reaction center where the charge separation occurs and real chemistry happens. There's this little interface where there's this small complex called FMO after the people who first crystallized it, Ben and Matthews Olson, which acts as a quantum wire to transmit energy which is from this fluorosome complex, which is already now electronic energy in molecules, because the event of light absorption creates an electronic excitation in a molecule, in a single molecule. That excitation moves through here. It comes to here and then it moves through there. Now, we don't know how it moves through here, but based on experiments that were done, basically photon echo type experiments that were done on this little system, taken out of the natural system, put in vitro, and then excited with a three-pulse photon echo like this, whether this is some population time. So basically, we have here, looking at the coherences, one would create a ground excited state coherence here with the first pulse. The second pulse here brings you up into the everything up into the excited electronic state. It's a band of excited electronic states. In this little complex, there are actually only 7 chlorophyll molecules, so that's really a lot nicer for theorists to think about than hundreds of thousands up here, where not even the structure is very well known. There's 7 here. They've got numbers. They're our friends. We know exactly where they are. We know how they're oriented relative to each other. We also know what's around them. So these swirls, so the blues are the heads of the chlorophyll. The chlorophyll has a tail as well, and the tail sort of anchors the molecule with a specific orientation in the swirling structure here, which is a protein scaffold. So this is a classic pigment protein complex structure of a light harvesting complex. Lars pointed out that this could be the Large Hadron Collider, but oh, it's not your LHC. It's our LHC, just a small LHC. This is a classic structure here. This actually is quite anomalous, that guy. So I won't talk about it. This is a classic structure. So this, and it's also amenable to both theoretical and experimental work, so that's why so much fuss has been made on it. So you can think about this as a hydrogen atom of light harvesting, if you like. Or the E. coli, if you're a biologist. So the idea of the experiments that showed coherence is that you have a three-pulse, so these are femtosecond pulses, optical, so visible wavelength excitation of one of these molecules, supposedly one up here, one up there, actually it's broadband excitation. First pulse creates a coherence between ground and excited electronic state. Second pulse puts you up into the excited state. So there are 7 chlorophylls. That means that there are 7 excitons. 7 excitonic states. These are the states where there's one molecule excited in the system, and the excitation is coupled between different molecules by a dipole-dipole interaction. So the same as dipolar molecules. Okay, so lots of that. So these Hamiltonians actually look quite similar to what we look at in excitonic transfer in dipolar molecules, or any dipolar system, actually. So up here, you're in the excited, so everything's then in, so here's the ground state, zero, and this is then E1 up to E7. Okay. So when you're up here, in this time period here, the system is in some superposition of these excited states, and it evolves. This brings it back down, coherence with the ground state, and then the signal's measured here. So these 2D multidimensional spectroscopies do a Fourier transform of the signal as a function of these two times. So one has omega 1 and omega 3. And then you see sort of peak structures which tell you about the correlation between excitation and de-excitation for a given time of dynamics in the excited state. So it's correlation, excitation, de-excitation. So now if I had a PowerPoint, I have a very nice movie. I'm very happy to show it to anybody. So what the Fleming group, Berkeley, did was this is one, see? And then they varied. They collect then, so you have a two-dimensional plot for one particular value of capital T. Then you vary capital T, and you get then a whole series of these plots. And then as you vary capital T, these peaks move around. And you see what they saw was that this peak here would go in, go away, come back, go away, come back, go away, come back. And particularly the off-diagonal peaks would go away, come back, go away, come back. So here they see quantum beats. And the this is the experimental signature. Quantum beats in the third order, the signal here, which is a third order polarizability. So it's a highly, it's a small signal, but everything is phase and energy matched. So you can actually isolate that signal from other signals by looking at specific points in space. You see these quantum beats, and the suggestion was that therefore these quantum beats, because they're occurring during this population time t, reflect the dynamics, the quantum dynamics in this of a single excitation moving through this set of excited states. So the interpretation is electronic coherence. So there is, however, a question. What is the role of vibrations? There are a number of questions. The only one I'm going to mention, because it's also relevant here, is, well, how do we know that it's pure electronic and there's not some vibrational motion? We don't, as the answer is. This is still somewhat of a raging debate. But one way to find out is possibly to do coherent control. So if we have a three-pulse photon echo setup, we can control the phase and the amplitude on each of these peaks. Okay? And there's actually a large group, a collaboration of people here who are working on doing that and trying to see to what extent we can actually determine, in the first instance, just determine the initial or make a select initial state for this population, to try to understand whether it really is just a pure electronic coherence, or so how do we do something with vibrations? Well, we could actually couple a Raman excitation of a vibrational mode together with this electronic mode to see this. And that's then the very last point here on the cis-trans-isomerization of rhodopsin, which is a primary event in vision, and it's also...
Yeah. The question is, should we take questions or let you do the last one? I'd rather have an opportunity for questions unless you can do it quickly.
I can do it really quickly. So this is another...
It's only one, too, yeah.
This is just a cis-trans isomerization. It's very... Actually, cis-trans isomerizations are very common, as I've learned since being here now from the biologist. They're very common in development. So there's related compounds are very important for development. And the biologists would actually like to have something which would control this cis-trans isomerization. In particular, retinoic acid, they only make the trans, and that's an important one in development, but they would like to switch off the developmental key by transforming to the cis. And this actually has been, so this isomerization is very interesting because it proceeds via a conical intersection. So a conical intersection, you have at the conical intersection, you have a very close coupling of electronic and nuclear degrees of freedom. In this case, Dwayne Miller, who will be here later in the semester, has done a coherent control calculation, coherent control experiment on a related system where he had done amplitude and phase shaping of this initial photo excitation without anything with vibrations. He then sees a modulation, and he can change the percent yield of the isomerization by about 20%, which is big. Right? What you could do here in terms of understanding the effects of vibrations is, first of all, do a Raman excitation here to create a specific vibrational coherence based on what you might know about the vibrations that are active here. Then you go up to the electronic state with your tailored vibrational state here, and then you go through. So that's, I think, a new direction where coherent control should add something. That's it. Sorry for that.
So coherent, there must be a question.
Probably dissipated everyone's patience. Yeah.
Biological physics, tabletop evolutionary experiments are sort of the rage in certain labs. Select on bacteria that have certain properties, or yeast, or other microorganisms. Yeah. Could you imagine doing this with quantum effects in mind? That is maybe selecting for lower temperature. I mean, something that can.
Now there is a group. There's a group doing that.
Temperatures or
something? Well, not so much low. So these experiments, I should add, they carried out. They were initially carried out at 77 Kelvin. Now they've been carried about out at 350, and you still see oscillations at room temperature, but they die out faster. So these oscillations at the low temperatures persist till about one picosecond. There is a group, this is Greg Scholes in Toronto, that is studying a light harvesting system of a particular type of algae, where it's very easy to generate all sorts of, entire trees of artificially evolutionary related organisms. And so they're doing that, then they're just going to systematically do this kind of experiment to see at what point in this artificial evolutionary system, at what point did this either come in, or was it much stronger and it went away?
When you say they're generating entire trees, you mean they're looking at specific mutations?
It's a multi-year project. Yes.
Brigitte, can you say something more about this turning off of retinoic acids, this transisomerization development? What's the idea there?
Well, so in development, fat retinoic acid is found and is very important in triggering development of all. I mean, you have to ask David Ben-Simon, who's I think not here today, but I can give you papers on that. And they would like to switch it off in order to be able to basically to control the development stage gives you a new probe to looking at how the development actually works, if you can switch it off in some places. So it's a deselection that they want to do.
In vivo?
They would start doing it, eventually in vivo. But first of all, they would want to do it in vitro. Yeah.
Yes, please. For me, this this open-loop control learning part and the feedback seems related somehow.
Well, we had a lot of discussions in our program about that.
Which I missed, so.
That is.
Today's Monday.
We have one right after lunch. Carry on. But the real, I can just say one thing here, but there are other people in the audience who will want to say probably a lot more. In the learning control, you're not feeding back in real time. You're going off. I mean, your graduate student could actually go off, have a meal, do a little calculation, come back the next day and run the experiment again. There's no need for this to happen in real time. In the measurement base.
I understand that. I just thought on a more conceptual level somehow. In the end,
Well, if you want to make, I mean, it just depends, as someone said in our program earlier, it depends how big you want to make your box.
Okay.
If you want to make your box, your control box, so this is what we would normally say, feedback that everything's inside the box, we say there are two boxes, but if you wanted to have this all inside the box until you get to the very end, when you're satisfied, then they would be the same.
Yeah, that's what.
It's, yeah.
All right, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.